once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wallop with our English debt.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the first thing we have to do is tell you that The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of an investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, who neither approve nor disapprove of our actions, but they do regulate us.
Yes.
And the second thing I need to tell you is that we do not pay for this radio program, nor are we paid for this radio program. We do advertise on KTEM, and we advertise for the radio show on KTEM, and I've got to disclose all that to you. The information that we provide on this radio program has been obtained from sources, and here's my favorite word, we deem reliable and accurate, but we make no guarantee
like
or
that.
Warranty as to its accuracy or completeness. Make no guarantee or warranty. I mean, that's pretty...
Either or.
Either or. None of the above. Let's see, there's probably something. Oh, yes, and the information we provide on this radio program is educational and not advisory. In other words, we're not giving you investment advice. It's very inappropriate to give investment advice on the radio because your individual situation and everything about you results in investment advice, but we don't know who you are and we don't know your total background. So we're not giving investment advice. We're giving educational information. I think you got it all.
I think so.
I'm, you know, if I practice this enough more years, I may get good at it.
Click it or tick it.
Close cover before striking is a standard one, but a lot of people don't remember that one. Let's see. Maybe hot.
Maybe hot.
Yes.
Yes.
Contents may be hot. Yeah.
Hot water may be hot.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Coffee, if you get it at McDonald's, if you read the cup, it definitely says the contents of this may be hot. May be hot.
It may be hot.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it may not be, so you'd have to try it out to see, but I wouldn't recommend pouring it in your lap.
We do not confirm or deny that the coffee may or may not be hot.
That's correct. All right.
Yep. There
so
we go.
Telephone
there
number are... in here. If today is the is leap day for you.
It is leap day for me.
This is February 29th, the day that never really existed.
Or only occasionally exists.
Occasionally exists. Matter of fact, my wife was talking to me this morning about the fact that there's a woman who's 19 years old because she's born on February 29th, but she looks like she's about like 76.
What you look like can be confusing, you know, don't judge a book by its cover.
So?
Or bleep your baby on the way they look, because she's really 19. In about 8 years, she'll get to buy alcohol.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I think she's already buying alcohol, so we need to check
on that. We're going to have to... You need to ID her.
Well, she's only had 19 birthdays. That doesn't mean she's 19 years old. The 29th of February is a weird day, and so are we entitled to be weird today?
I think if that's our excuse, we're entitled to be weird, but I think any day is a weird day, so we're entitled to be weird.
If today is February 29th, 2020, where you are, you have the ability to give us a call at 254, well, if you're outside the United States, 1+254. And then dial 773-1400. And somebody got it so quick.
773-1400. So we have a caller. Should we take the caller?
I think so.
Caller on 773-1400.
You're
on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. Obviously, this past week was kind of crazy. If you believe the talking heads, sounds like they've pointed out some vulnerabilities in production shortages and things like that. Do you think after this crisis is over that they're going to, some of the businesses and technologies will flow back into this country, or are we going to just go back to sleep and do business as usual? Hang up and listen. Thank you.
I don't think we're going to go back to sleep and do business as usual.
No, I don't either. We were already making permanent shifts to the supply chain in China. That's something that if you look at the effects of the trade war, quite a lot of the supply chain has begun to move. With the coronavirus, okay, rather than talk about what's happening at this moment, I'm going to backfill in some history. Over the last 20 years, as as we have filled up our labor market with more and more skilled jobs and moved less and less into manufacturing here, we've looked around to say, okay, where can we have these built? Where can we have these put together and brought back? The labor cost has to be cheap enough that it makes up the difference in shipping. So if it's in China, you've got thousands of miles to bring it back. And if you had to supply the folks in China, you had thousands of miles to take it there the first place. So flights and shipping have gotten cheaper over the last 15 years, so it's made it easier to move to China. Something that's kind of been invisible, though, is that the price we paid at the beginning when we were moving the supply chain to China, and this, where was it before? Some of it was in the United States, but a lot of it was in Japan. People don't really remember that, but if you look back to, like, the movies Back to the Future, you'll see that the Japanese were a rising economy and a lot of stuff was being made there that used to be made here. They became more and more wealthy, and it got more and more expensive to make things in Japan. Their population is slowly shrinking. They're getting more and more educated. So we shifted the supply chain to China. There was no major event that made that happen. It was just a slow thing, and the price was better. Businesses, humans in general, but business runners and decision makers aren't really good at recognizing when the temperature of the water that they're sitting in is rising slowly. So in China, over the past 15 years, the cost of doing business there has been rising. Their standard of living has been rising. Their wages have been rising. Their economy's been growing. And that's all good for the people of China, but it makes each item more expensive. And that could go on for a long time because it costs a lot of money to build the factory. And you'd have to shut down a factory in China to open it up somewhere else. It's still worthwhile in certain circumstances. And with the coronavirus, this is the thing that's pushing it over the edge, that's pushing it way, way into the supply chain is too long and complicated. Even if we go to a full free trade environment, and the only threat to that is political. The tariffs could happen by anybody involved in that trade, anybody along the way. That's a political threat. And you can say, all right, we can weigh the political threat and see how hard that is if we've got a supply chain. People are already saying, all right, the political threat's too much. Let's go to a country that's not quite so large on the political spectrum like China is. So they're moving the supply chain. Well, now the question that the caller asked was, is any of that going to be coming back to the United States? And my answer to that is long-term, all of it will, but not in the form of jobs. It'll be automated. If you're going to need to build a new factory anyway, and it's going to cost, say, $2 billion to build the factory, you're probably going to do it more in line with the way Tesla's been doing it, which is push the envelope and see how much we can automate in the process. So it may come back, but don't expect manufacturing jobs to boom in the United States.
There's a good study reported in Financial Times, or is either The Economist, I don't remember which one it was, but I read it I read the article in detail, and it indicated something interesting. In fact, in areas in, I think, Italy and Germany, where they had gone highly automated, in other words, they put in a lot of robotics during the 2007 through 2009 recession into manufacturing plants. The end result in the local area was a dramatic increase in jobs.
Right, but not manufacturing jobs in
well,
the same
they,
sense.
They were related to the manufacturer that automated, and the end result, though, was a net increase in jobs.
Right.
And I think as we go, and we've said this for years now, and we've said that there'll probably be a recession in 2020. We said it's likely to be a black swan that caused it, and this is a black swan. But the big thing is automation is going to replace people making things.
And that is the future. I mean, it's just going to happen.
It's also the past. I mean, the cottage industry, the first industrial revolution was cottage industries for handmade clothing.
Yeah.
Literally or done in the cottage.
Or the Quakers. Or the Shakers. The Quakers and the Shakers were communities that were begun in the cottage industry, and they were using newer hand tools to build furniture and things.
But the Industrial Revolution is when textile manufacturing moved to factories generated by the energy of waterfalls or dams or water wheels.
Eventually steam.
And then steam. But this has been a progression ever since the Middle Ages, and it is it's going to continue. It's going to probably accelerate, and I think in the 2020s we'll see a dramatic return of manufacturing to the United States, but not a dramatic return of high hourly jobs doing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, Walt Whitman, this is not recent, just as a side note, but Walt Whitman said, man has become a tool of his tools. This is something we've been talking about for a long time, going all the way back to now you're plowing with a thing that you're pulling behind animals. That's a form of automation. The first driverless cart was the one where the horse knew how to get the kid to school. So we're following down a path of automation that's been started when the very first invention started. And our jobs change with the new technology. They're not going to be the job that you remember. It's going to be something new. We're not going to stand with a set of with a wrench in your hand tightening lug nuts on tires at an automotive plant anymore. A machine does that. And at some point, getting your tires replaced will be you drive into it and it analyzes the tire and tells you some choices and you choose it and then it replaces your tires for you. I mean, that's not a huge distance away. What about the people that repair tires today? What's going to happen to their jobs? Well, in their lifetime, they're probably not going to lose the job to an automation. But when they stop working, they're not training new people to do it. So the automation is going to take over. That's a non-black swan event, change in job environment.
But it takes a recession to slow things down enough. And Jake's talked about this a lot. It takes a recession to slow things down enough that people can afford to retool. If the coronavirus creates, and I want to talk about that, if the coronavirus creates a recession right now, in the immediate future, there will be idle factories with nothing but the managers and owners around, and they will have the opportunity at that point to retool because they just got a shock because the employees didn't show up. Well, they can't afford to not have employees show up because they'll go broke. If employees don't show up, and they'll start retooling to create automation, the dependability of the China supply chain has now been called into question for the first time. I say into question. There's a lot of people saying, "Man, I wish we didn't have our supply source in China."
Yeah, twice. One from the trade war, and second from there's a crazy disease that just popped up.
And the issue then is people are going to look at the things that they didn't have. For instance, if there's one part made in China and there's a U.S. manufacturing assembly line, they may have some reserves of that one part. But if that one part, they run out of it and it's not coming from China and there's no ready source of them in the United States, then the entire factory has to shut down. And that is going to be serious issue.
I expect we will have shortages of quite a number of things in the near future. And people in the United States don't like that, and they're willing to pay extra to not have the shortage. So that means that there is a demand there for a shorter supply chain. And here's the way this usually
happens. Well, that or a more diversified supply chain.
Right. And here's the way this usually happens. The factories that were made in China were, by and large, not pre-existing companies that said, I'm going to scrap this factory here and I'm going to make another one over in China. Instead, it was an up-and-coming company that said, how do I make this item that I want to sell? And they looked around and they couldn't find a good place to put a factory, and then they got a good deal in China. And so they retooled or tooled completely new the factory in China, but these factories in China are now decades old. There are newer technologies that can be incorporated into factories. But when those factories were made, the labor was so cheap, you really didn't need to spend a lot of money on automation. So now when a new company, an up-and-coming company, and these start quite often at the depths of the recession, when the people are out of work and they start innovating and they say, hey, I have an idea, I'm going to go to work for myself. Then they say, I'm going to do this thing that I've been dreaming about for 20 years. This is a new idea. I need to manufacture it. Well, these new companies are very unlikely to open a factory in China at this point. 5 years ago, it would have been the place to go. They may decide to look at Vietnam, or they may decide to look at the Philippines, or they may decide to look into other new concepts and ideas about automating here. And that's what I expect to see really thoroughly starting whenever the next recession comes. If coronavirus is the reason for the recession, then it's going to happen during this recession. If coronavirus is shown to be not that big a deal, which that's not the way we're looking at it, the economic impact is going to be big enough that China could have a negative GDP quarter for the first time in about 40 years.
So let's talk about the market.
Okay, let's do it. We haven't done that.
Since the market was a little bit interesting this week, the Standard Poor's 500 stock index, and technically that's the SPX, dropped 11.49% for the week, 11.5%. And it's down 12.76% since its high on February 19th. February 19th was an all-time record high. It's dropped 12.76% since an all-time record high. Now, that sounds really terrible until you realize how high it was. We've still got about a 5 1/3%, 5.4%, 5.36% gain for 1 year. Is that likely to stay? Probably not. I kind of still think that Monday morning we're going to open up and people are going to have thought about it over the weekend and start selling. But the good news is that on Friday, the market technically fell compared with the close of the previous day. But if you go from the opening bell to the close, it was actually up a little bit. And that means that the worst of this immediate fear has passed. Now, the fact that we just got reporting this morning that there's some new coronavirus outbreak, there's people in along the West Coast who are showing up with coronavirus who did not appear to have contact with anybody else that we know has coronavirus, which means it's probably spreading in the United States. That will probably cause a fresh wave of panic. But the good news is here, and I want to emphasize this, we've had past panics from epidemics, and they tend to be V-shaped. In other words, there's a steep drop on the front end, a sudden turnaround. By the way, there's no forecasting when that turnaround would occur, and a steep rise on the back end. There's no way of telling how long it'll last. But it's temporary. And why is it temporary? Because virus epidemics burn themselves out after a few months. It's just the nature of epidemiology. They've discovered that there's no question. The Chinese are now seeing a reduced number of new cases each month. Now, they may be lying, but I don't think so. Each day, rather. And when this turns around, it's going to create a huge run up because it will be this tremendous built-up demand that people will come back into. How long will that take? It could be the end of the year before we see it really mature on the top side. It could be a few months. The important thing to recognize is this is not 2007 through 9. This is not a financial structural recession. This is something caused by an external force at the top of a mature market, a mature economy. So that's the key thing. Now, the other thing that happened in the market, other than the fact that the stock market dropped rather precipitously until Friday when it kind of leveled off, and we're officially in a correction now because we're over 10%. The big thing to understand, I mean, one of the big things to me is we did break a record last week. By the end of the week, the end of week close of 1.168% yield on the 10-year Treasury note is the lowest I can find anywhere in history. I may have dipped below that at some point intraday, but I don't think so because I couldn't find any record of it in the charts. And it makes sense. This all makes sense. I know that sounds really goofy, but it makes sense. The Standard & Poor's 500 stock index rose 29% last year. Earnings for Standard & Poor's 500 companies were virtually flat. I think they were technically up 1.9% for the year. But when you consider that we have inflation that's about 2%, in other words, the earnings weren't up last year. But the stock market rose 30%. And that's one of those things that we've discussed in our newsletter. We've discussed on the radio. This is when, at the tail end of a bull market, the stock market takes off and ignores reality. And at some point, something comes along and wakes up the traders to the reality of the situation, and they make a correction, which is why we call a drop of 10% a correction. And we've got a correction going on. And just buckle your seatbelts. This correction is going to take place. The stock market is not the economy. However, the stock market is one of the main leading economic indicators for the economy, and I strongly suspect that in March, when the index of leading economic indicator comes out, it's going to be pretty negative. The service sector has held things together up till this point. The manufacturing sector of the economy has, for the last 6 months, been in a recession. There's no question that it's in a recession. And it's probably going to get a lot worse now that supply chains are broken up. The key here is to recognize that recessions happen and they're good things. We don't like them. You like recessions?
Nobody likes recessions. I think that without them, though, we don't innovate.
It's kind of like a forest fire.
Or, yeah, go ahead with the forest fire.
One of the reasons that we have severe, really, really bad forest fires now that are just horrific is because we've done a real good job of stopping the little forest fires. So that what happens is little forest fires burn along the base of the trees and burn out the broken limbs and dead trees and things that have fallen over the years. And if you get the little forest fires and you let them run, the little fires, then you don't get the big one. But if you allow all that dead wood to build up and build up and build up, when you finally do get the fire, it is horrific and it burns out all the trees and it's uncontrollable and it burns houses and it just does terrible things. We need little recessions. One of my favorite examples of what happens if you don't have a little recession, the Soviet Union went for 70 years without a recession.
Yeah, I've got an economic theory I've coined with a nice
cattail
name. Yeah. It's the cattail theory. And the cattail theory is that when you regulate something overly long, you have bad consequences when the regulation is lightened, and sometimes before. So I call it the cattail theory because if you have a cat that's sitting on the couch next to you and you look down at the tail and it's just got a very tiny twitch at the end of the tail. It's just this little thing. But that annoys you a little bit. So you reach down with your hand and you grasp the tail semi-firmly to the end of the tail to prevent it from moving. What happens when you let go? Anybody that has ever had a cat will know that the small anomalies that you are getting to stop by holding your hand over them become quite large. The tail movement is much more volatile in economic speak. You got swings all over the place. So this idea of how to regulate, a light regulation keeps the swings mild, but isn't something that's so bad that when it's removed causes the swings to get really wild.
Well, we now have an inverted yield curve that's really seriously inverted. So unless the Federal Reserve chops interest rates really dramatically in the immediate future, we will keep an inverted yield curve for a period of time. This is the second inverted yield curve in less than a year, severely inverted yield curve. And I looked back and couldn't find an instance where we had two severely inverted yield curves. And with an interruption in the middle, where we didn't wind up with a recession within a year. So I would say the chances of a recession in 2020 are pretty darn high right now. And again, I think it's something we need, because we need to clear the dead wood out of the system. We've talked about this before. There's a lot of zombie companies out there. They're not viral infected. They're just zombies.
Yeah. And this is, you can hear it in the terms that are being used at these companies. The term burn rate is now a technical financial term. What's your burn rate when you're talking about a startup or a company that's just received a whole bunch of money and they're trying to increase their market share? They're trying to get more market and they're not concerned about profit yet. So the burn rate is how fast they're going through the money that's been provided to them. And there are a lot of companies that have only ever had burn rate. And if you think about the most recent big IPOs, you'll hear in a lot of those, and I would even say the majority of those cases, you've got a great market share and no path to profitability, and people are still willing to pay a lot of money for that stock. Now, Facebook went to market that way. Amazon went to market that way. A lot of companies that are tech companies went to market on, we have a big market share and we'll figure out profitability later. If you count all the companies that say, hey, invest in us and we'll figure out profitability later, what you're going to find, and this is a really easy thing to go through and find, is that the vast majority of them never find the path to profitability. They just got a lot of customers and still not making any profit. What is that old thing? We can make it up in volume. There's an old saying you have said to me.
Well, it was told about the guys that I actually met at one point. He was selling watermelons, and they realized that they had paid too much for their watermelons they bought from the farmers. And they bought them for a dollar. Well, I'm just going to use modern. Yeah. It was actually cents before. They bought them for a dollar, and they realized that they could only sell them for 75 cents, but they thought they'd make it up on volume.
Yeah. So that's a lot of the startup community right now.
I think they both ran for Congress and were successful.
So that's we wouldn't necessarily call that a zombie company, but it might be a zombie company. It's likely even to be a zombie company, but you don't really know until you put them through a little hardship. There are different ways of coming to market with a product. There's the one where you leverage yourself to the hilt and you get loans for everything. There's the other one where you do sort of the equivalent. You sell your company to a bunch of investors, a big chunk of your company, to get the money in there. Or there's the other one where you start profitable because you're doing the thing and then you grow with the profitability of growth. And those are long-term, much more reliable new companies coming into the market.
And by the way, there's a lot of numbers out there. We're focused on the coronavirus and the immediate effect and the big numbers, but there's a lot of numbers out there that, but most of what you see, for example, new house sales were up in January and into February.
That's a good sign for the economy.
There's a lot of things that, but all that's lagging. And the problem is that now the coronavirus is a real threat. You just basically take all the lagging information, set it aside. But one piece of lagging information that I think was quite significant that we mentioned, I think we mentioned it last week. The U.S. purchase manager, the market, U.S. purchase managers.
And market isn't spelled the normal
index,
way.
MARKIT, the PMI. Their composite turned negative in January the first time since the Great Recession.
Yeah.
Now, the composite is a combination of manufacturers, a weighted combination of manufacturing and services. The fact that manufacturing actually improved just a little bit in January, by the way, I think it's going to turn around pretty dramatically in March, was good. But the services sector declined. It was still positive, but it declined. And it declined fairly substantially down to
the growth rate declined.
The growth rate declined down to a point where it was basically flat in January. Now, that indicates the economy has been running on consumer spending, the services side of the economy. That's what runs the show in the United States. And we've had really good growth over there. We've had like 3% growth, 3 to 4% growth for the last several years in the services side of the economy. What services side? That's for the prime example I can tell you is when you go out to eat.
Yeah, you get served.
And you go out to eat and it's consumer spending and it generates profits for the restaurant and for the people who create the food for the restaurant and for the electric companies and lots of other places.
And another would be when you go get your taxes done. That's mm-hmm. a service industry.
Or when you get your plumbing fixed or when you – anything where you don't actually buy a physical product. Now,
someone is doing something for you.
That – if we follow – well, we got a caller on 773-1400. Hold that thought, Jeff.
Yes.
We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, what is 200-day moving average?
why is it important for a long-term investor? Why not 50-day moving average? Why not 2,000-day moving average? Thank you.
Good question.
Good question.
Yeah. The important thing about the moving averages, the longer-term moving averages, is they tend to forecast what's coming.
Okay. Yeah, so what is a moving average? It doesn't actually move. It's taking a graph of the long-term average of a given thing that you're measuring. So if you're talking about the S&P 500, a 50-day moving average, it says what's the average movement over these 50 days and spreads it out evenly across that 50 days with kind of a regularized trajectory. It takes away the bumps. And 50 days takes away less bumps than a 200-day, and a 200-day moving average takes away less bumps than a 300-day moving average, and a 300-day moving average is right around a year, just as a side note, because it's when you're talking about the market, it's not open on weekends or holidays. So you got to factor that in there. A 2,000-day moving average is going to have things that don't represent the current status of anything in the market today. Because it's looking back so many years that you're incorporating different market cycles into the movement of the market. Why would you use a moving average? You were saying it's a good indicator.
There's a lot of noise in the market. There's a lot of bumps up and down that are short term. It drops and it comes right back again, like it did in last year or December of 2018. And you get these bumps in the market and you can panic when you see a bump and say, oh my God, the market's going down, and try to bail out or try to change your behavior because of it. The longer the moving average, the less noise you see and the more the major trend that you see. Yeah. And we kind of look at the 300-day moving average as a good sign. Generally speaking, if the S&P 500 goes down below the 300-day moving average of its price. In other words, each when we say a 200, 300-day moving average, by the way, the last 200 days, a 200-day moving average is you go look back 200 days and say what was the average price of the stock, or average price of the S&P 500. And then the next day you move the whole 200 days forward one day.
Mm-hmm.
And you move it forward again one day. And we, by the way, have concluded that the 300-day moving average is probably significant. And if it goes below the 300-day moving average for 2 weeks, there's a pretty high probability we're in for more dip. We're in for a bigger fall than what we've already seen.
And from a technical perspective, a lot of technical analysts are out there saying, oh, yeah, moving averages, this is great. Technical stuff means that you're not looking at the fundamental reasons that the company is doing well. You're just looking at the trends in buying and selling. And so we like to use it on an index rather than on a given investment because – as much as people try, it's really hard to predict an individual stock movement based on moving averages. Well, the overall market, we can say with some historical reliability, if this S&P 500 goes below its own 300-day moving average for a couple of weeks, it's probably going to be down for a couple of months. And if it only is down for a week in that process, then it may be up again immediately, or it may go down in the future. So it's not a perfect crystal ball, but it's a nice little thing to say, should I be buying or selling in the market right now? If the market is below its own moving average and you consider it to be fairly priced, then it's a good time to be putting money in. And if it's above its own moving average, which means it's higher priced than it has been over that entire period, then you're in a growth mode and you may not want to be investing lots. Unfortunately, most people do the opposite. When it's above the moving average, they buy in, and when it's below the moving average, they sell out, which is it's a buy high, sell low is not a good idea, folks. But a lot of people do it. Do you still have your thought in mind? Because we have another caller coming.
Go ahead.
Do you have your bookmark still firmly in place?
No, but that's okay. Let's
have you lost the bookmark?
Let's take the caller.
The page has been lost. Okay, caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was wondering if you gentlemen noticed that you had time yet. The Clean Daily Herald business section A8 on the right side briefcase is good news. The General Motors add 1,200 workers at two Michigan factories.
Well, that's good.
That's pretty great.
That's great news.
It's certainly great news.
Well, wouldn't that be something you might want to buy into, a little
well,
General Motors, if you had enough?
The problem is, if you also read a little further down, not maybe in the Clean Daily Herald, but if you look at General Motors right now, they are in a bit of a cold sweat because virtually every car they make has at least one critical part manufactured in China in a factory that's not manufacturing right now.
Now, this is not necessarily going to be great news to a lot of people.
I told you, Muller, Michigan.
Just a second. Tesla has a supply chain that's about 98% Tesla. The older the company, the more likely their supply chains go all over the world. So that is one of the things to be looking at as a factor. And a lot of people look at Tesla and they say, "Well, I know a lot of people are like, what are your feelings on Tesla?"
Well, I love the ideas of the outgrowth, but part of the General Motors has always been in Lower Michigan. There are so many satellite plants that could refire up in Lapeer, Pontiac. Even in Tennessee, all the way up and down I-75.
The problem is, if you can't get the parts,
and you can't get the workers,
and you can't get the workers to show up for work.
Oh, no, you get them all over.
Satellite
plants.
We're talking about the fact that there's a virus that's going on.
And it might be possible. If we react the same way China did, then a lot of people aren't going to show up at the factories.
General Motors has some huge assembly plants, and they make a lot of parts in the United States. But there's parts that are only made outside the United States, and you'd have to build a new factory with new equipment, which would take months at the very quickest.
Well, I agree on that part.
Yes. No, I wouldn't. I would not say the fact that General Motors hired 1,500 people means you should buy the stock.
What we like
World
to
War II, what General Motors did in the lower half of Michigan, you talk from Saginaw, Bay City, Flint, had 13 General Motors plants.
Sure.
Yeah, and one thing to know about indicators, any kind of economic indicator, hiring is always a lagging indicator. You hire after you've already got more profit. You fire after you've already gotten less sales. It's not something that you do in advance unless you're a pure startup, and then you don't really know what's going to happen. So you never make it. General Motors is a great company, but you never make a decision on whether to buy a given investment based on whether or not they hired in a given month.
What is the possibility they can get those dies, tool and die, and shipped from over there over to here?
No, it isn't going to happen
right away.
The problem is you have to build a whole new factory to make the highly technical electronic parts that go into cars today.
It's not a metal part that they're concerned about. It's the electronic parts.
Cars are driven by computers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right now, your car won't work if your computer doesn't work. And they outsourced many years ago the making of those electronic components. And there's nobody in the United States. We don't have the employees in the United States or the capability or the factories to make them. Now, could we retool and do that? Sure.
Yes.
About a year from now, we would be online.
Yeah. 6 months or a year,
Well, not 6 months. About a year.
It depends on how rapidly we did it. If we went into, like, war mode.
In World War II. That's what I was going
right.
to get at.
But we're not in war mode.
Changeovers don't take 3 to 6 months in a war type.
It only takes 3 to 6 months if you're using tool and die equipment. If you're having to start from zero and build chips and build circuit boards, it takes longer.
Well, we got a lot in Texas going on that, in Austin and Round Rock.
And can we recover from this? Yes. Can we get to the point where we're independent from China? Actually, we could at any moment. It's just, are you willing to pay twice as much for an automobile as you're paying now?
What happened to our Japan days? Japan was always buddy buddies with us.
I don't understand your question.
Yeah, I mean,
the electronics. But Japan was always smart on electronics when they first took it a little. When we had more of a diet appetite for Japan products.
Yeah, their population has been shrinking and getting more educated. So their price for labor has gone way up from what it was in the 80s. That's why the supply chain moved to China from Japan. You know, all the VCRs that used to be made in Japan, and then it went to DVD players in China, because when they went to retool to make a new plant, they realized that making the plant in Japan wasn't a good idea. The labor costs were rising too fast, so they went to China.
And earthquakes.
Yeah, earthquakes too. Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks for calling. Oh,
yeah. And a lot of sushi.
Yeah, thank you, guys. It make a lot of sense, and some things that a lot of people don't think about.
Appreciate the call.
Enjoy listening to you.
Thanks.
Thank you
very much for calling.
You asked, am I still, you know, there I am again.
Yes, you had a bookmark.
Yes, you asked about the bookmark. I think, and I'm going to see if I can remember where the bookmark was. I think what I was talking about is the longer term effects of what we're going to see here in this virus. The chances of us avoiding contagion in the United States, I think, are somewhere between zero and none. And I don't know if then there's
so
technically
fractionally
a difference.
Between there, though.
Fractionally between
somewhere,
zero and
some
none.
Fraction of zero and none.
The contagion's already started. We've got people who are showing up in, or who have been diagnosed in California.
In Washington and Oregon,
who have not been in contact with somebody who's a known virus carrier, which means that it's already spreading and it's spreading. One of the problems is also one of the blessings. The vast, vast majority, probably 80% of the people who will contract or have contracted the COVID-19 virus.
Coronavirus.
Have very little symptoms other than that of a mild cold. In some cases, they don't have any symptoms at all.
And that's part of the reason why it spreads so fast.
And they're still contagious, and they don't cough, they don't sneeze, they just spread the viruses around. The difficulty is that none of us in the United States have any immunity to this virus. Almost all of us have some degree of immunity to every form of influenza that comes out because we've had
some
cold.
Mutation of it at some point in the past.
Yeah, there's a common cold virus that's going around that is probably the direct descendant of the 1918 flu virus that was devastating in many ways to the United States economy at that moment. It caused a recession all by itself, and this is probably a replication of that event, although it's a different kind of virus. And the reason that the 1918 flu epidemic was so bad, there's lots of statistical reasons for it, but the bottom line to it is it was a novel virus. It was not one that we had previous immunity to.
A novel, that's like a fictional book, right?
Novel simply means new. And this is a new virus, so we don't have immunity to it. And probably a significant portion of the people in the United States will get it. And most of them will have a mild cold. The effect economically won't be from the death rate, which will be pretty substantial.
Within reason.
61,000 people last winter died of influenza. 61,000 people.
67,000 in 2018. Yeah.
So what we're looking at here is an infection that will probably infect more of the people in the United States than influenza did, probably a lot more. Maybe 4 to 6 times the number of people will get the infection. The death rate appears to be slightly higher. And so we are probably talking about hundreds of thousands of people who die. And unfortunately for me, I'm 70. It's mostly people over 60 and people with compromised immune systems. And that's not really pleasant for me to think about. But the reality is these things come along from time to time. The economic effect won't be that of an influenza outbreak.
It's going to be bigger than the influenza outbreak.
We're scared of it.
Yeah, and this is kind of the root of the issue. Let's kind of drill in. We tend to be afraid of the wrong things, but that doesn't mean we don't react to the fear. That's very important. If you look at the death rate from this and the number of people that were infected, there are 2.3 billion people in China. And we've got less than 3,000 deaths. So if you put a statistic on that, you got a lot of zeros after the decimal point before you get any actual numbers that show up as a percentage of the population that died. But it shut down a big chunk of their country. It shut down a whole province completely. And Beijing had 37,000 restaurants closed. That's a lot of restaurants to close, and Beijing's not in Wuhan province. So the economic impact of fighting a novel disease is sometimes worse than the disease. And it's kind of, there's a really cool analogy and a meta analogy, if you will. It's usually not the flu that kills you. It's the other stuff that happens because your body's fighting so hard against the flu, it raises your fever. Well, your fever isn't caused by the virus. It's caused by your body's response to the virus. So our nation and our world response to the virus may be worse than the virus, but it also may be important to do it anyway. Because the best case scenario is already not going to happen. Best case scenario is it's completely contained and it's never going to come back again. It only happened in a very small area and it's not going to spread because they got it trapped and quarantined and that virus is dead forever. It's never going to mutate and come back every year. We're already past that point. That is not the scenario that we're seeing. It's leaked. It's all over the world at this point. And once it's all over the world, we're past the point where you can say, don't spread anymore. You can't really stop it, because even if we do a really, really good response in the United States, it's going to mutate somewhere else in the world and come back again next year and the year after that, just like influenza does. It won't be as scary then, because we've already seen it. We won't probably even have much in the way of news about it when it comes back again. The news is about it being new. Isn't that why they call it news, I think? It's new. It's novel. It's this new disease, and people can get it, and it's scary. It is scary. But when you think about the dangers that exist already, the flu exists already, heart disease exists already, people die in tens of thousands on the road every year. And I am a firm believer that generations from now, when I've got grandkids and great-grandkids, and they're talking to me about the way I used to live and how dangerous it was. You mean there was only paint keeping you from somebody driving a multi-ton machine, and they could have crossed that paint at any time and killed me? And how many tens of thousands of people died from that? And we measure wars. I mean, Vietnam War. How many people died in the Vietnam War? American deaths. And how many people died of flu in 2018? So the cause of death is one of those things that we put a lot more emphasis on things that are different from what's happened before. The Vietnam War was different, so we concentrated on the death rate. The coronavirus is different, so we concentrate on the death rate. What we need to do is take some pretty nice steps back and look at history and say, look at the response that's coming out to this new virus. There are no less than four places in the United States completely independent from each other and not sharing research that have come up with preliminary vaccines that are going to trial very soon. And each of them is a different form of the vaccine. Eventually that may get centralized. But right now these vaccines are underway and they'll maybe in 8 to 9 months come out and be ready to use, because it's a novel virus. We didn't have something pre-made in the expectation of flu season coming up or cold season coming up or coronavirus season coming up. When I look at how fast we were capable of coming up with the probable solutions for the virus, that's what gives me optimism about the future. Our technology is advancing. We're better at the things that we used to do. And we haven't played commercials yet this hour. Goodness, we're getting on a roll. I'm going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join the conversation, we won't have a whole lot of time left this hour, but the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side.